Hey everybody, welcome back to the Curiosity Chronicles. Back after a month off. It was good, I think, to take the month off. Had a few people giving me a hard time about it, which I appreciated actually, because it means people wanted to listen. But was able to do some better research and kind of get my motivation back for the podcast. So I'm glad I took the month off, but I'm glad to get back into it as well. Today, we are talking about the whale ship Essex. This is some story, believe it or not. This is kind of kind of one of those stories you never hear about. And then when you do hear about it, it's like, how did I not know about this beforehand? At least that's how I felt. I might be the only person on the planet who is interested in this. I hope that's not the case, but I do catch a lot of grief because I have a weird fascination with whaling. Historical whaling, of course, not like nowadays. But I don't know, I find it fascinating, and this was a great story, I thought, so I thought I would turn it into a podcast. So, without further ado, this is the Curiosity Chronicles. My name is Brett Bielsma, I'm your host, and this is what I was curious about this month. So before we jump into the meat of the story, the whale ship Essex, we need to talk a little bit about whaling in general and the history of whaling specifically in the United States or previous to the United States in the colonies. Now there are many reports and stories, books, everything that you read claims that Native Americans were whalers. However, there's very little evidence to support this. There's not anything that proves definitively that Native Americans did anything other than cut up whales that were stranded on the shore. That was a common practice, but there's nothing to indicate that they were hunting the whales. The archaeological evidence that people use for proof could easily have been the tools of the trade for hunting seals, which was much easier prey, much more common practice. So this lack of evidence doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but there's no way we can prove that it did happen. In terms of Europeans or colonists, the Dutch were the first to take whaling seriously. That's when you first started getting actual proof that it was happening. This was in 1630. Two ships owned by the Dutch West India Company set sail, and their goal was to get whale oil, and they especially wanted to get the oil to make soap. And it was a fairly unsuccessful voyage, but it was the first Europeans to successfully hunt whales in America. They weren't very successful, but they did kill some whales. Now, early colonists in the 17th century did not go out and hunt whales. They waited for whales to come to them. Stranded whales, whales that got beached and died on the beach, then were cut up and used for all the various purposes that whales were used for, which was not meat. Generally speaking, they were used for function, not for eating. The whale meat was edible, but colonists did not approve and didn't taste very good. Colonists started to get impatient. They didn't want to keep waiting for whales to come up on shore. So around 1650, they started shore whaling, which was just taking ships a few miles offshore and hunting whales close to the beach. And at this point, they were mostly looking for maybe occasionally a humpback whale, but more readily available were a type of whale called the pilot whale. But the true target was the right whale, R-I-G-H-T, right whale. That was what they were searching for when they were shore whaling. And in the 1700s, the island of Nantucket became the capital of whaling in the Americas, and this lasted for quite some time. I'm going through this very rapidly. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this. Just give you a general brief overview of whaling in the United States. If you are a super nerd like myself and you're interested in getting a more in-depth look at the history of whaling, one of the books that I used mainly as the primary source for this episode was a book by Eric J. Dolan called Leviathan. and it's the history of whaling in the Americas. Eric J. Dolan is one of the authors I also used heavily for the pirate episode. He's very good. Check him out if you're interested in seafaring type nonfiction. But anyway, I digress. Now, early 1700, possibly around 1712, there was an especially important voyage in whaling history. And that was, according to the story, the voyage by Captain Christopher Hussey and his men. They sailed out in small boats. They were blown off course. And when they were blown off course, they fell in with a school of sperm whales. And they harpooned it and brought it back to shore. Dead, of course. Harpooned it, killed it, brought it back to shore. Now, there's some issues with this story in terms of timeline, because if it did truly happen in 1712, it couldn't possibly have been Captain Christopher Hussey, because he would have only been 12 years old. So the timeline doesn't quite line up. And based on where this supposed story took place and the behavior of sperm whales, there's some discrepancies in the story. But it's been told so many times that it doesn't matter if it's true story or if it's an apocryphal story, because it is the definitive story of how Nantucketers discovered the sperm whale. And that's the important part. Not how they did it, but that they did it. Now, sperm whales are incredible animals. I'm such a nerd about this, so I don't know why. I'm totally fascinated by it. Like, four people are going to listen to this episode, and none of them are going to be as excited about it as I am. But I can't help it. It's just, hey, it's my podcast, and I wanted to do this, and maybe people will be more interested than I think they will. Whatever. I can't help it. Sperm whales are crazy, though. They're awesome. They are the largest toothed whale. So obviously the blue whale is larger. Blue whale does not have carnivorous type teeth like a sperm whale. And so the sperm whale is considered the largest toothed whale. And the bulls, the males, currently as of right now, in the past they may have been larger, but right now, current 2022 time, they can reach up to 60 feet and weigh 50 tons. That's a big animal. And they have the largest head of any animal on the planet, which contains the largest brain of any species. And they can dive deeper than any whale, up to like thousands of feet, even up to a mile at times, and can stay down for over an hour. That's just fun facts about sperm whales. Just thought I'd throw that in there. But why were sperm whales important to whaling? Now, over time, they became the holy grail of whaling for three main reasons. The three reasons being its blubber, something called spermaceti, which I'll get to, and something called ambergris, which I'll get to and is kind of gross. Actually, all of this is kind of gross. Let's be honest. Whaling is just kind of a gross industry. Now, sperm whale blubber was not nearly as thick as other whales, but it could be rendered into an oil that was much cleaner burning, and it was much more valuable because it was more highly sought after than other whale oil. So when at the time they would use the whale oil in lamps, different oils from different whales would burn with a little bit more of a smoky acridness to it. Sperm whale oil burned much cleaner and much less sooty, and was therefore valued because of that. One of the other reasons is something called spermaceti. Now, there is an organ in the whale's head, a sperm whale's head, called the spermaceti organ. It's a large liquid-filled compartment in the head of the whale. That liquid is called spermaceti. There could be up to 3 tons or 23 barrels of this oil in that organ. Now, elephant in the room. If you know Latin, you know what spermaceti means. And I'm just going to say it. This is not the reproductive fluid of a sperm whale. But unfortunately for early whalers, based on how it looks, they thought spermaceti was the reproductive fluid of a sperm whale. That's why they named it that. And that's also why a sperm whale is called a sperm whale. Wildly inaccurate. But you can't blame, 1,700 whalers for the miscommunication there, because it does look a lot like it. Now, spermaceti was very valuable as a source for oil, for illumination, just like the blubber. But it also had medicinal purposes. And spermaceti also, when it was made into a, when it was exposed to air, it would solidify, and it could make candles that were much better than your normal wax candles. Again, cleaner burning and more highly sought after because of that, therefore making it more valuable. But if you think spermaceti is gross, now we got to talk about ambergris. Now, ambergris is a very rare gray or black waxy substance that is formed in the stomach or large intestines of sperm whales. And then the whale basically craps it out. And it could be the size of a baseball, or it could be in chunks that were hundreds of pounds. And it's so rare and hard to find that it's literally worth its weight in gold. And nobody knows exactly, from what I understand, what it's caused by, but it's most likely caused by irritation to the bowels of a whale, which is super gross, especially when you find out that this has been used for multiple purposes throughout history, including Egyptians burning it as incense. King Charles II of England ate it for breakfast. Just disgusting. It didn't say if he knew where it came from or not, but I have to assume, why would you eat a black waxy substance for breakfast? Anyway, it doesn't matter. In history, Arab people used to put it in their coffee, and Italians added it to chocolate. But mostly what you find, the use for ambergris and why it became so important to the whaling community and also valuable, is it was a fixative for perfume. It was added to perfume to help the scent of a perfume last longer and be a stronger scent for a longer period of time. So that was its most widespread use. Due to trade restrictions, it's not used nearly as much nowadays, but there is still rumors of some of the more premium brands like Chanel and Gucci, and I don't even know how to pronounce this. I think it's Givenchy, are still rumored to use it. So if you're using high-end brand perfumes, there's a good chance that one of the ingredients came from a sperm whale's crap. Sorry. So over time, shore whaling became less popular, and especially from Nantucket, these whaling voyages would go out into the open water and hunt down sperm whales. Kind of how you think about whaling in general. Large ship, large crew, out on the open water for long-term voyages. So how did they hunt a sperm whale? Pretty simple, honestly. There's a lookout that was posted on the ship looking for the puff of a whale's blowhole. And then if they saw it, they literally, it's just like you would hear in like a cartoon. They literally would yell out, "There she blows." They would get in the smaller whaleboats. A whaleboat is generally about 27 to 31 feet. It is propelled by oars. And it was light but strongly built and double-ended. And once a whaleboat got close enough to a whale, a harpooner or a boat steerer, they were called, grabbed his harpoon and got ready to stick it in the whale. A harpoon is a double-barbed iron dart with a 2-foot shank mounted on a pole made from hardwood. The pole was thick enough for a man to wrap his hand around and about 6 feet long. They often kept the bark on the pole for grip. And then attached to the harpoon was a hemp or manila rope that was 100 or more fathoms long. And 100 fathoms equals about 200 yards. So you got a very long rope that's coiled in the boat. The best harpooners were accurate from tens of feet, which made me laugh when I read that. It's not very far, but it makes sense. This is not an easy task. But ideally, you would get as close as possible before the harpoon was thrown. And despite what some people may think or what is sometimes portrayed inaccurately, a harpoon is not meant for killing. They are designed to hold the whale until the whale tires out. Once a harpoon hits the whale, that's the most dangerous part of a hunt. a sperm whale has a tail that is humongous. It's 12 feet wide and can easily smash a whaleboat, can easily injure or kill a sailor. And a lot of these sailors, if their whaleboat was smashed, did not know how to swim, so then they would drown. So extremely dangerous to get too close to the whale when you harpoon it. And sperm whales were especially dangerous because they could attack with their huge tail or fluke, but also they could turn around, use their jaws. Remember, they had their toothed whale, or their head, which is basically like a giant battering ram, which is important later on that we're going to get to. So, dangerous profession. But once a harpoon was attached, it was sometimes attached to a large block of wood called a drogue, but more often it would stay attached to the boat and basically turn the whaleboat into a drogue. And they had to be very careful at that point, because if the whale dove, then someone had to play out the rope rapidly so that the whaleboat was not drug underwater and swamped, or they would use a hatchet to cut the rope before they were drug under. But if the whale started swimming away and the rope was attached to the whaleboat, they got taken on what's called a Nantucket sleigh ride, which probably was pretty scary, but also pretty exhilarating, because they would be towed behind the whale, cruising at about 15 to 20 knots, which comes to about 17 to 23 miles an hour. That's not slow speeds. And that would continue basically until the whale tired itself out. Once the whale was tired out from dragging this boat around, they would row as close as possible, and that's when the quote-unquote captain of the whaleboat, which was usually the captain of the main ship or the first or second mate, would use the lance for the killing blow. A lance is similar to a harpoon, but not quite. It is a large teardrop-shaped, extremely sharp knife which is mounted on a pole. And the goal was to strike the whale and pierce either its lungs or the massive arteries and blood vessels near the lungs so that it would kill the whale. And then once they got that killing blow, they'd churn it around as much as possible to do as much damage so that the whale would die rapidly. Pretty gruesome, not very humane. I'm not a PETA supporter or anything like that, but this is brutal. They might have to stab the whale up to 15 times before they got that killing blow. And then once they got the killing blow, they knew that they had hit the right spot, because the blowhole would blow out a massive amount of blood and gore. It was really gross, but that's how they knew that they had struck the killing blow. That's what sailors on a whale ship called chimney of fire, when this massive geyser of blood came out of the whale's blowhole. Then they would back off. They would row away. A whale, when it goes into its death throes, swims in ever-tightening circles and may also gnash the water with its teeth and smash the water with its tail. Basically, it just violently swims until it dies. But circles around, circles around, circles around, finally dies. Once the whale dies, they would row back. A mate would cut a hole in the side. Nope, excuse me. Getting ahead of myself there. They would cut a notch in the tail, would attach a wooden kind of a dowel attached to a rope, and they'd tow it back to the whale ship. And that's when the cutting stage started. Obviously, killing the whale is important, but in order to make the whale profit, they needed to turn that whale into oil, basically. So they would lower down a narrow plank that men could balance on, and a mate would hack a hole in the whale's side and attach a hook. Now, that hook was attached to a block and tackle and a windlass, which is a machine for moving heavy equipment on a whale ship, like the anchor, or in this case, blubber. And they would basically use that block and tackle to rip a 5-foot wide strip of blubber from the whale. It was 5 feet wide. It could be up to 20 feet long in one giant strip. They would lift it up, bring it onto deck, below deck actually, where it would be cut into manageable size pieces. That was just repeated basically until all of the blubber was stripped from the whale. Once the blubber was totally stripped, whale was decapitated and they cut a hole in the spermaceti organ. I looked it up. I was pronouncing it wrong. It's spermaceti, not spermaceti. Not that important, but anyway. They would cut a hole in the spermaceti organ and use buckets to remove the up to 500 gallons of oil. And if you were the unlucky sailor, you may have to actually get all the way down into the hole that was cut in the head of the whale to make sure that all of the oil was taken out. They didn't want to lose a drop. That's basically money. After all of that oil is taken out, they would use a lance to probe the intestinal tract looking for ambergris. And after they had found that or determined that there wasn't any, they would finally cut the whale loose and let the carcass float away. Now, at this point, if this is not gross enough, they had huge tripods, which are just large pots used for trying out blubber. Trying out is basically getting the oil from the blubber. They had huge pots going, and they were, there was a fire lit under the pots. They used wood to start the fire, but then as they added the blubber into the pots, there would be pieces of the blubber that would float to the top called crackling. I don't know why I repeated that. And those are skimmed off and then used as fuel for the fire. So the whale blubber was the fuel for the fire that turned the whale blubber into oil. It's a very efficient use of materials, obviously, but it was also incredibly disgusting because the crackling burned with a horrible, messy, acrid smoke and an incredibly nauseating smell. Whalemen described it as beyond description, literally, of how bad it smelled. And not only that, but then the smoke was just a very nasty, black, acrid smoke that kind of got everywhere. It was an extremely gross, bloody, primal, messy work. The decks and the men were stained with blood, there was spilled oil, there was blubber, and this would last for 3 to 5 days. But eventually, this whole process would end with oil being put into barrels and stowed in the hole. The hold, excuse me. So all of that for just a bunch of barrels of oil. It's kind of disgusting. I hate it. But that is a little bit of the basics of whaling. But enough of that. We got to get to the real point of this episode, which is the whale ship Essex. So the whale ship Essex was an older whale ship, but for the purposes of this story, it was on a voyage that started in 1819 from Nantucket. And it had a crew of 21, and most important for the purpose of this story, we'll hear about some other ones later on, but the captain was a man named George Pollard Jr. He was only like 28 years old, I think. He was young, but not unheard of for a captain. And then his first mate was a man named Owen Chase. Second mate, Matthew Joy. And then the cabin boy was a boy, 15-year-old Thomas Nickerson. And he's important because he wrote a firsthand account of the following events that historians have used as primary source talking about this. Owen Chase also wrote another account. But there are many different accounts that were maybe not necessarily written down in a book like Chase or Nickerson, but Pollard told his story to a lot of people and it became well known. This is all pretty strongly verifiable fact, what I'm about to tell you. So the Essex set sail on August 12, 1819. And right away when a whale ship sails, the mates pick their whaleboat crew. There's going to be 3 whaleboats, one commanded by the captain, one commanded by the first mate, one commanded by the second mate. And they did it not unlike kids do on a playground where there's first and second captains and you take turns picking. So they went ahead and set the watches and then picked the crew for their whaleboats. The captain and the mates wanted as many Nantucketers as possible. That's a big thing. They wanted to get the Nantucketers on their whaleboat. If they ran out of Nantucketers, they wanted to get the off-islanders, like the people from Cape Cod. And then finally, the last members that were chosen were usually the members that were black. It was kind of clicky on whaleboats, for sure. Nantucketers were definitely preferred, and then the social castes went down until you got to the minorities, which sometimes were Native Americans, but more prominently at this point in history were the African Americans. And it's 1819, but these were free African Americans, but it's still 1819, so yeah, we're not going to get into that, but it is unfortunate. Now, whaleboats at this time were heading towards the Pacific, so they had to go all the way around Cape Horn of South America and get to the Pacific. There's obviously no Panama Canal at this point, so they have to take the long route to get there. And for whaleboats specifically, they took even a more circuitous route because they actually sailed towards Europe and Africa first to take advantage of the westerly winds, and they stopped at the Azores for provisions, and then they would pick up the northeast trade winds back to South America, past the equator, hopefully miss out on the doldrums, which is the notoriously dead air zone near the equator, and then they would make their way around Cape Horn. So it was a very circuitous route, which was surprising to me. Things did not start well for the Essex. 3 days out from Nantucket, the weather began to get stormy, and they were getting rough seas. They did not take the sails in. They were fully rigged at this point, which was a little bit odd because, generally speaking, whale boats aren't really in that big of a hurry. They're just out there looking for whales, and once they fill up their hold, they can return home. But it's not like they were a merchant vessel that has to deliver its load of whatever they have to make money before it spoils. So there was really no reason for them to be fully rigged, but that's about what they were. And they didn't shorten sail when they saw the storm approaching because they miscalculated how strong the storm was going to be. So when it starts coming at them, they realize, okay, this is probably going to be a problem. And they decided they were going to turn away from the direction of the storm, but they decided that too late. So the storm slammed into them in the side, which is about the worst position for a ship to be in, and it rolled the Essex almost 90 degrees onto her side, which is called knocked over in the sailor's terms. So they got knocked over. Ship is severely damaged. Sails are torn to pieces. Cookhouse was destroyed. But most importantly, two whaleboats were completely lost, and the spare was crushed. It could be repaired, but it was severely damaged. Usually a whaleboat requires a minimum of 3 boats with at least 2 spares. The Essex was down to 3, and one of them needed to be repaired. So Pollard wanted to return to Nantucket for repairs. They were close by. They could return. It would be a little bit embarrassing, but it could be done. The first mate, Owen Chase, disagreed, and he and Matthew Joy were in agreement that they should continue on to the Azores. They could get a new whaleboat in the Azores and continue on without a problem. And Pollard, in what will continue to be a theme in this story, instead of being the iron-fisted captain who makes the rules, decided to acquiesce to the more democratic process and reversed himself, and they carried on. They did not go back to Nantucket for repairs. So January of 1820, the Essex rounded Cape Horn. They had not been very successful so far. They had gotten a few whales, but not really. Actually, at this point, they may have not gotten any whales. I don't recall for sure. Either way, they were not doing well. And fortunately, once they got into the Pacific, they were off the coast of Peru, and their luck started to pick up. They had about 450 barrels of oil from this area, which is the equivalent of about 11 successful whale hunts. Now, Pollard wanted to try for this new whaling area that was way out in the Pacific called the offshore ground. And it was at this point that they had about half their cargo. They were hoping that if they got to the offshore ground, that they would have a large amount of whales to hunt, and they could have a full cargo of oil and be back in Nantucket after 2 years on a voyage, which was about normal for this time. 2-year voyage, is what to expect. Maybe even 3 years if you're a little bit unlucky. Nantucketers didn't see their family very much. So they stop for provisions once again at the Galapagos Islands, and then they sailed more than 1,000 miles into the Pacific. They were far into the unknown. This was, like I said, a newer whaling area, so it was not as well known what was around it or the civilizations nearby. And there weren't even that many civilizations nearby other than some islands that they knew about, like the Society Islands. That's what they called them in 1820. We now know them as French Polynesia, which would be, like Tahiti. The trouble with the Society Islands is that they were rumored to be inhabited by cannibalistic natives, so they were to be avoided. On November 20, 1820, the Essex really ran out of all luck, is when things started to go extremely poorly for the crew. They had spotted whales and get in their whale boats. The boat of First Mate Chase harpooned a whale, but the whale knocked a hole in the boat with its tail. They used a hatchet to cut the rope, let the whale go, and returned to the Essex for repairs. Pollard and Joy, in their two boats, were out hunting successfully. They were attached to whales and were in the process of going in for the final kill. While they were back at the Essex, Chase's crew was going through the repairs. Cabin boy Nickerson was at the wheel and he saw a whale. A massive whale. They estimated it to be an 85-foot bull sperm whale, weighing about 80 tons. And this is possible. I said earlier that bulls get to be about 60 feet long, but in 1819, before all the massive bulls were hunted and natural selection took its course, it is definitely possible that there were larger sperm whales out there. I believe that there's a museum that has, I think, the jawbone of a sperm whale that is estimated to come from a 80-foot whale. So an 85-foot whale is definitely not out of the realm of possibility, but it's still a massive sperm whale, bigger than any of the crew had ever seen. And Nickerson noticed that this whale was acting strangely. It was not fleeing as you would expect a whale to do when it comes close to a ship, but it was about 100 yards away, just watching the Essex, which is a little bit creepy. The whale dives, resurfaces about 35 yards from the ship. The sailors could see the scars on its head. It had obviously been in fights and was a whale that was clearly used to violence. It didn't appear threatening at first, it was just kind of floating there, and then it charged. It used its battering ram-shaped head to smash into the Essex on the port side. It hit the Essex, which is a large ship, hard enough for every man to be knocked from their feet, knocked them all down. Is the first time in the history of Nantucket whaling that a whale had ever attacked a ship. So just not something that happened. It was completely unexpected. Now the whale swims underneath the ship and is now on the starboard side, appears a bit stunned, and just kind of floated there next to the ship. It just rammed straight into this ship with its head, so you can imagine it was a little woozy. Owen Chase, first mate, had the chance at this point, while this whale was acting lethargically, to lance it and try to kill it before it could do more damage. He's about to take the lance and drive it into the whale, and he realizes that because of the way they were floating so closely, that the whale's tail was extremely close to the ship's rudder. Now, if he was to lance this whale, it's a possibility he could kill it, but there was also a strong possibility that in Killing this whale, it could thrash its tail and destroy the rudder of the Essex. They are thousands of miles from land. They cannot lose the ability to steer their ship. So Chase decides not to risk it. Just let the whale be. Again, a whale has never attacked a ship. There are even some that speculate that this whale hit the Essex on accident. That is not how it's portrayed by Chase or Nickerson. But come on, it's not going to happen again, right? So it takes about a minute. The whale recovers and swims until it's about 600 yards away. Chase said in his account that it was snapping its jaws and thrashing its tail, quote, as if distracted with rage and fury. It's like this whale had like a weird vendetta or something. So now it's ahead of the ship, and it's again starts coming at the ship like a battering ram. It's moving at about, they estimated, 7 miles per hour, and it's moving at the bow of the ship, so the ship is moving towards the whale as well. So combined, the speed of the two is probably about 10 miles an hour. The whale smashes into the port bow, and it hits it with such force, and it's such a powerful animal that it actually pushes the 238-ton ship backwards to the point where it actually started to swamp the ship. It's a mortal blow. The ship's lower deck started filling with water, and the Essex was sinking. The whale was apparently satisfied with this outcome, swam away, it's never seen again. That whale was just as pissed about something, and it took it out on the crew, or took it out on the boat. Chase gets his boat crew back in the whaleboat, and fortunately for them, the steward, a black man named William Bond, who's apparently the most level-headed man on the planet, grabbed Pollard and Chase's trunks. And that was extremely important because those trunks contain the navigational charts and equipment for the whaleship Essex. So possibly could have saved multiple lives by saving that navigational equipment. Shortly thereafter, the Essex capsized but didn't actually sink. So it capsized, and it was at that point that the men in Pollard and Joy's boat looked back and realized that there was a serious problem. They released their whales and rowed back to the Essex, or at least where the Essex had been, to confer with Owen Chase and his crew. From the first attack to the capsize was 10 minutes. This is a rapidly deteriorating situation. The fortunate part was the Essex did not sink completely, and they were able to hack away some of the spars and the masts, and actually the ship somewhat righted itself, but still was definitely sinking and capsized. But they were able to get back on, cut holes into the hull, and salvage some supplies. They were able to get two large casks of bread, about 600 pounds of hardtack, which is basically an extremely solid form of bread. It's just flour and water didn't spoil because it was basically like a rock. They got some casks of fresh water, and they got some tools and equipment like boat nails, muskets, a couple pistols, and some small amount of powder. And I didn't mention it before, but I briefly said they stopped at the Galapagos Islands. When they stopped at the Galapagos, they had got some tortoises basically for food. And some of those tortoises were swimming around, and they grabbed some of those out of the water. I think each whaleboat maybe had two tortoises or something like that. So they had some provisions, but there are still 20 men in the whaleboats in the middle of nowhere. Now, at the beginning of the podcast, I said there are 21 in the crew. If I remember correctly, at one of the early stops for provisions, one of the crewmen was sick and left behind. So he never made the voyage. There were 20 men, and they were in three boats many, many miles from land. So before they could do anything, they had to prepare the whaleboats for voyage on the open sea. And they did it in a couple ways. They salvaged some needles and twine, and using sails from the Essex, they basically jury-rigged sails and masts for the whaleboats so that they didn't have to rely solely on rowing. And they also used wood from the wreck to build up the sides of the whaleboats by about 6 inches, which proved to be crucial. They said later, Nickerson and Chase in their accounts, that as they got weaker, if they had not built up the sides of the whaleboats, they probably would have taken on too much water for the men to bail in their weakened state, and it was definitely possible that the whaleboats could have sank. So that 6 inches was crucial. Now, they discovered at this moment that the wind was blowing them away from South America, which is exactly where they wanted to be. So that is not a good first step. So the whaleboats, they could only sail with the wind. Realistically, with a larger ship, you know, you can tack against the wind. I don't really understand sailing at all, but I know that with different sail setup, you can do what you need to depending on the way the wind is blowing. They didn't really have that set up on these jury-rigged whaleboats, so whatever way the wind was blowing, that's pretty much the direction they have to go. So backtracking to South America, which is about 2,000 miles away, was considered impossible given the wind and ocean currents. So they started talking about other options. The closest islands to the west were the Marquesas Islands. They're about 1,200 miles away. Now, reports claim the inhabitants of these Marquesas Islands were very violent and had a reputation for cannibalism. So they decided that the Marquesas were to be avoided at all costs. And then the other islands were the Society Islands. We talked a little bit about the Society Islands. It's a large conglomeration of islands, but some of the more famous ones are Tahiti and Bora Bora. Those are the ones I've heard of. And those were about 2,000 miles away, and Pollard decided that was the safest option. Let's head for the Society Islands. And with any luck, they were expecting to reach the Society Islands in about 30 days. So not too bad of a voyage given the amount of provisions that they had salvaged and the distance they had to go. Chase and Joy disagreed. They believed that they did not know enough about the inhabitants of the Society Islands, and they were under the impression from rumors that they had heard that the natives of the Society Islands were most likely as cannibalistic and violent as the inhabitants of the Marquesas. So Chase and Joy instead proposed a different, much longer voyage. They thought the safest route would be to sail south for about 1,500 miles until they hit a band of variable winds that they could then use to sail east to Chile or Peru on South America. So they go south to hit the trade winds that would be able to take them east instead of west. They believed that they could do this in 56 days based on wind currents, where they were, and where they needed to go. And they also had done the math, and they had believed that they had food and water that should last them for 60 days. So it was a feasible plan. They could just barely make it if everything went right. Why they thought everything would go perfect is beyond me, but that was the plan. And Pollard, once again, gave way to the more democratic process and decided to go ahead with the plan of Chase and Joy, which was a fatal decision. Not fatal for Pollard, spoiler alert. But it was a fatal decision for many. And it was also a woefully ignorant decision, especially concerning Tahiti. Since 1797, there had been an English mission on Tahiti, with reports of them being a very peaceful and easy to work with indigenous people. And several months before the Essex had sailed, there was a report with latest news from the Marquesas that had made its way to Nantucket that basically said all had been peaceful on that island since about 1812, and there were no reports of cannibalism. So either they hadn't read the report, which seems most likely, or they were ignorant of it all. They were ignorant of it altogether, or did not believe it. But one way or the other, the ignorance of the mates and Pollard led to an extreme amount of suffering. There's really no excuse. They should have gone for Tahiti or the Marquesas, and they would have had a much better chance of surviving without the awful suffering that's about to come. But that's not what they did. So the crew splits up. There's three boats. Pollard got most of the Nantucketers. Five of his seven crewmen are Nantucketers. Chase gets two Nantucketers and six. Two out of the six on his crew are Nantucketers, and the rest are off-islanders. Nickerson was on Chase's boat as well. And then Matthew Joy got the rest of the off-islanders, people from Cape Cod, and most of the black crewmen. Joy was in a rough spot. He was suffering from an illness, most likely tuberculosis. It was not looking like he was going to have a successful survival voyage. And therefore, and I don't mean this for myself personally, but in the 1820 viewpoint from the rest of the crew, Joy was given the leftovers. He was given the off-islanders and the black crewmen. Basically, the crewmen that the other crews didn't want. Each boat was given 200 pounds of hardtack and 65 gallons of water and two Galapagos tortoises. And they were autonomous, but they did try their best to stick together, and they were successful for quite a while. Each boat had to ration the amount of food that was given to each man. I believe, let me see if I remember it, Chase's boat, because it was more damaged, had six crewmen, and then Pollard and Joy each had seven crewmen on their boats. So that's not a lot of food to go around based on the provisions that they had. So rationing was very strict. 6 ounces of hardtack and half a pint of water a day is what each man was given. And it was, that is an extremely small amount of food. It's equivalent to about 6 slices of bread and 500 calories per man per day. That is a starvation diet, legitimately. About a quarter of the daily energy requirements needed for a man who is 5'8", weighing 145 pounds. They only got a quarter of what they needed. And even worse was the water situation. They were on a half pint ration. But in order for the human body to remove waste, the minimum amount a human body needs is a pint of water a day. The sailors from the Essex were on half of that. So they are in dire straits. And they were just unlucky. Really, they really were. After a few days at sea in the night, Pollard called out to the other boats. His whaleboat had been attacked by an orca, or killer whale. Like, what kind of twisted, sick joke is that? And it slammed its head into the boat and bit a chunk out of it, and they had to repair it. He had transferred some of his provisions to the other boats and did the repairs. Now, due to a couple different circumstances, including this orca attack, Pollard and Chase's hardtack had been contaminated by seawater, which was an extremely bad situation and bad luck. They get on their way, and it's shortly after that that the men in Chase's boat, a lot of this comes from Chase's account, so I do talk about Chase's boat, first mate Owen Chase's boat more often. Nickerson was also on that boat, so he also wrote the firsthand account, so I tend to gravitate a little bit more towards them just because that's what the primary sources were. But at this point, they started suffering from overpowering sensations of thirst. It was all they could think about. That's what they talk about. They could only think about slaking their thirst. And what was happening was they were eating the hardtack that was contaminated by salt water. That was causing the kidneys to extract more fluid from their already depleted bodies to excrete the salt. and they started to suffer from a condition called hypernatremia. It's excessive amounts of sodium that can bring on convulsions, and it is about the worst possible thing that can happen in shipwrecks. This is on November 28, so it's been 8 days since the attack, but it's been 6 days since they actually left the wreckage, which is how I'm going to usually talk about timeline, not from the time the ship sank, but from the time the whaleboats actually left the Essex and started on the voyage to the open sea. So it's getting bad enough at this point that the men on Chase's boat finally decide they're going to eat one of the tortoises. And so they butchered it, and they were able to actually start a small fire in the tortoise shell, and they cooked and ate every edible bit of the tortoise. Some of them even drank the blood of the tortoise. And I am so thankful. This makes me a little gaggy even just thinking about it. I am so thankful that I've never been in such a dire situation that drinking blood was seen as a relief. Because that is just, I can't wrap my head around that at all. Of the two primary accounts available, Nickerson and Chase, neither says anything about saving some of that tortoise for later, which is a little bit surprising. An average-sized tortoise would have provided 3 pounds of meat, 1 pound of fat, and a half cup of blood per man, which would be about 4,500 calories, which is like a large Thanksgiving dinner. And it's unknown how the shrunken stomachs were able to contain it and how it was able to produce enough of the digestive juices to digest it. But from all accounts, it appears that the men gorged themselves in one huge meal. By Sunday, December 3, 1820, the men had finished up the contaminated hardtack, which was good and bad. It was bad because now there's less food for them to eat, but it was good because now they were not introducing salt into their body through the contaminated hardtack, meaning that they were less desperately thirsty, still very dehydrated, but less so. They tried to collect water in their sails when it rained during a storm, but they found out that the sails were so permeated with salt water from the ocean that they might as well have just drank water from the ocean itself, so they were not able to salvage any water from rain. Also, terrifyingly, this storm produced waves that were up to 40 feet high that the boats just had to ride out, and all of the men expected to die. But whaleboats are resilient. They rode it out. They actually stayed together, too. They weren't separated in this huge storm. All three boats right around the same area. Now, they're getting into desperate straits at this point, and I say that knowing what's coming. It's already getting desperate. It's December 9, 3 weeks in the boats, roughly, and they've been in the boats. They are starving. They're severely dehydrated. They got 3,000 miles to go. And again, they could have avoided it all. Right at this point on December 9, they could have sailed west with the wind and the waves. They could have been in Tahiti in a week. But despite their suffering and their starvation and their dehydration, they still decided to continue on with their original plan. Thomas Nickerson, in his first-hand account, wrote, quote, "I can only say there was gross ignorance or a great oversight somewhere which cost many fine seamen their lives," end quote. Now this part of the episode gets a little bit more of like just like a timeline kind of thing. I'll try to keep it as interesting as possible. December 12, second tortoise was eaten. This is on Chase's boat, but you can imagine that it was similar on Pollard and Joy's. And December 14, they ran into an area of very calm weather, and it became clear that the original 60 days of provisions were not going to last them long enough to reach South America like they thought. They thought they were going to make it in 56 days. They hit this calm area. That's not happening. So Chase cut the rations on his boat to 3 ounces of hardtack a day. So they were already on a starvation diet, and now it's cut in half. The water ration stayed the same out of necessity, but they still weren't getting enough water. There was a study done by a man named W.J. McGee. He was curator of a museum, I believe. And he, in 1906, published one of the most detailed and graphic descriptions of dehydration. And the survivors in the Essex at this point are entering what he called the cottonmouth phase of thirst. Now I'm going to read this just so you can envision the amount of suffering that these men were going through. Described as this: saliva becomes thick and foul tasting. The tongue clings irritatingly to the teeth and the roof of the mouth. Even though speech is difficult, sufferers are often moved to complain ceaselessly about their thirst until their voices become so cracked and hoarse that they cannot speak anymore. A lump seems to form in the throat, causing the sufferer to swallow repeatedly in a vain attempt to dislodge it. Severe pain is felt in the head and neck. The face feels full due to the shrinking of the skin. Hearing is affected, and many people began to hallucinate. That sounds like the worst thing I can imagine. And that's exactly what the men in the boats were beginning to suffer from. Some of the men, in order to relieve themselves of just the awfulness of their condition, jumped in the water just to kind of cool down, hopefully experience moisture, and discovered that there were barnacles on the underside of their whaleboat, which they ate. And they harvested some more of them to save for later, but within a half an hour, I think it said, they succumbed to temptation and ate all of them. That was the only sea life that they were able to, quote-unquote, harvest. They couldn't fish. They were in an area of the Pacific that was extremely sterile. It's notoriously hard to get any fish or birds in this area of the Pacific because the water didn't have nutrients. All the nutrients are basically at the bottom of the ocean in this point. So they couldn't fish. They did have some luck in late December because they spotted land. They landed their boats on an uninhabited island called Henderson Island, although at the time they mistakenly believed that they were at a different island called Ducey Island. They were able to find some crabs, some birds, and they even found a little bit of fresh water, and they were thinking maybe they could stay here until they were rescued by some other whaleboat, you know, a ship of some sort. And that was a short-lived dream. They stayed there for 7 days, and it started to become increasingly clear that Henderson Island did not have enough food and water to sustain them for a longer period. So on December 26th, they made a decision that within the next couple days, they were going to leave the island back into the whaleboats and continue on their way south, trying to get to the trade winds to bring them to South America. However, 3 men, Thomas Chappell, Seth Weeks, and William Wright, decided that they would rather stay at Henderson than get back into the whaleboats, which, as difficult as it was to part, it works out because that's 3 less mouths to feed for the whaleboat crew, and it's possible that with it just being 3 men at the island, that the island had enough food and water to sustain them. So they stayed. The rest of the men got into the whaleboats and took off again. So back into 1821, it is now January 10, the first member of the crew dies. It's Matthew Joy. He was sickly before the wreck, and he dies on January 10 around 4 o'clock in the afternoon and is tied up in a cloth with a rock and buried at sea. And it was around this time that, during a stormy night, that the boats were separated for a time. And Chase again is forced to cut rations to 1.5 ounces of hardtack a day. Now, the good news for the men if you can even call it that, is they were able to drink enough fresh water at Henderson to stave off the immediate threat of dehydration. So now the biggest danger was starvation, not dehydration. The men at this point are so weak that they can barely perform the most minor tasks in the boat. They can't row, they can't steer the boat. They're basically at the mercy of the wind and the waves. January 16, Chase's boat was attacked by a shark, which snapped and bit at the wood. They tried to kill it with a lance, but they were so weak that they couldn't even scratch the skin of this shark with an extremely sharp knife. They had just no power in their body at all. Completely decimated. And same thing happened the next day. There was a school of porpoises. They tried to kill one of them. Zero success. They were just not strong enough to do anything. January 20, 1821, Richard Henderson, a black man on Chase's boat, dies and is buried at sea. And then also on January 20, this is 8 days after the boats had been separated, a black man named Lawson Thomas on Obed Hendricks' boat died. Obed Hendricks took over command of Matthew Joy's boat. Now, at this point, if I remember correctly, Chase's boat was separated, but Matthew Joy / Obed Hendricks' boat and Pollard's boat are still together. So one boat separated, two together. So Lawson Thomas dies. And it's at this point that the men start discussing what might be necessary to survive. They have been adrift for a long time. They are starving. They are all on the verge of dying from starvation. And they have a dead body in their boat. So they do what they got to do. They decide to eat the body of Lawson Thomas. So they avoided the Society Islands because of rumors of cannibalism. And in order to survive, they are resorting to cannibalism themselves. Not as uncommon as you would think in shipwreck survival at this time, but also not something that anybody wants to do, of course. So more than likely, and I apologize if you're squeamish, this is going to be a good time for you to turn this podcast off. Most likely, the first thing they would do is get rid of the obvious signs of the humanity of Lawson Thomas, taking off the hands, the feet, the head, and the skin. Most nutritious part of a body, kidney, liver, and heart would be removed next, and then they would try their best to remove the meat from the backbone, the ribs, and the pelvis. Pollard reported that they were able to light a small fire on a flat stone, roasted the organs, and began to eat. Now, anthropologists estimate that a normal human could provide 65 pounds of meat. Now, of course, Lawson Thomas, when he died, was not in a normal state. In his emaciated state, is estimated probably was about 30 pounds of food. They did what was necessary. Now, on January 23, another black member of Hendricks' crew, Charles Shorter, died. Now, it's unfortunate, but it's not surprising that the black crewmen were the ones that were dying first. They were more than likely not given as good of a diet before the shipwreck for most of their lives. But also a recent scientific study compared the percentage of body fats amounts in ethnic groups, and it claims that African Americans tend to have a lower body fat percentage than the Caucasian Americans. And once fat reserves are consumed in a starving individual, the body starts consuming muscle tissue, which eventually leads to death. So if you start with less body fat, you will die more quickly from starvation. And it appears that the black crew was suffering from that very thing. Charles Shorter passed away, was also butchered and eaten by his crewmates. January 27, Isaiah Shepherd, again, another one of the black men on Hendrick's boat, was passed away from starvation, and again, his crewmates ate him to survive. And it just continues. January 28, it's been 68 days since they left the wreck. Samuel Reed, a black man, this time on Pollard's boat, died, butchered, and eaten. The men in the boats at this point were no longer operating under what we would consider the rules of conduct that governed their lives previously. There have been psychologists who have studied inmates at Nazi concentration camps, and their studies could easily apply to the men from the Essex. I know that's obviously 100 years plus before the concentration camps, but it's the same type of situation. They were part of what these psychologists would call a modern feral community, is a group of people reduced to an animal state very closely approaching raw motivation. All they cared about was survival. That is the only thing that governed their actions. January 29, Pollard and Hendrick's boats become separated, so all three boats are now officially on their own. And on February 26, and this is the part, excuse me, not February 26, February 6, Pollard's boat runs out of food, the food that was formerly the body of their crewmate. And this is when things get the most horrific for me, as if eating dead crewmen is not horrific enough already. I mean, you can't even fathom that type of situation. If you haven't been in it, and not very many people have, of course, you just can't fathom it. And I don't judge either, because I would want to survive. You got to do what you got to do to survive. Sitting here in my basement, comfy, cozy, with a full belly, I think to myself, there's no way I could do that. And maybe that's true, but I don't judge. They did what they needed to survive. But it doesn't take away from the absolutely horrific nature of this whole ordeal. But it gets worse. This is the part that really just gutted me. February 6, Pollard's out of food. There's a 16-year-old boy named Charles Ramsdell on his boat. He's the youngest person on that boat. And he suggested something they were all thinking. He says, "We don't have food. We need to cast lots to see who should be killed and eaten, so that the others could survive." And this was, unfortunately, a fairly accepted practice in survival situations at sea. There's records of this happening as far back as the early 1700s. Pollard does not agree with that at first. He said, "That's not going to happen. We'll just make do somehow." But the rest of the crew on his boat agrees with Ramsdell, including 18-year-old Owen Coffin. Owen Coffin is George Pollard's first cousin. So, again, Pollard agrees. He acquiesces to the democratic process. They have scraps of paper placed in a hat, and the lot lands on his cousin, Owen Coffin. Pollard is distraught and offers to take Coffin's place, but Coffin, somewhat heroically, honestly, as 18, he basically says the lots were cast fairly. He asks for a moment of silence to himself. He gives a message to his mother for Pollard to take if he survives, and really quite peacefully goes to his fate. It's really remarkable, the composure that this boy had. They took lots to see who would be the person to kill him. The lot fell to Charles Ramsdell, the original proponent of this idea, who initially balked. When it came down to it, he couldn't do it. And they didn't really say in the account what happened, but it basically came down to necessity. I believe using a pistol, Ramsdale shot and killed Owen Coffin, who was then butchered and eaten by his crew members. It's just literally, I can't imagine a more horrific situation. I really can't. It's not like these were strangers. They were crewmen. The psychological toll that has to take is just, to me, it would be insurmountable. But again, I'll say it again. Do what you got to do to survive. On the other boats at the same time, all of the men were starting to come to the realization that they were on death's doorstep. February 6th, Chase eliminated rationing on his boat, just allowed the men to eat the bread and hardtack as they needed, knowing that they were all close to death anyway, so it didn't matter. February 8th is day 79. 79 days of this torturous voyage. Isaac Cole, a non-Nantucketer in Chase's boat, began to rant incoherently, began twitching spasmodically, and by 10 a.m. he could no longer speak. He would just lay in the boat and then randomly pop up and have these random convulsions. By 4 p.m. he had died, and it was most likely that he was suffering from, he's obviously suffering from dehydration and hypernatremia, but also probably a lack of magnesium, which in extreme cases can cause bizarre and violent behavior. At first, they did nothing, but throughout the night, Chase wrestled with this idea, and finally, for the first time in this particular boat, they made the decision to butcher and eat their crewmate, and it provided enough food for 6 or 7 additional days. And again, it just continues on. February 11, in Pollard's boat, a man named Barzilay Ray passed away. He was actually more of a boy. I think he was about 18. Passed away, was eaten, and unfortunately, the eating of their crewmates was giving the men slightly more energy. The men in Chase's boat were actually strong enough now to be working the steering oar, but they were also in huge amounts of pain due to boils all over their skin and edema, which is a swelling of the arms and legs due to an accumulation of fluid, which is common with starvation. February 18, finally, February 18, 1821, the men in Chase's boat saw a sail, and they were able to basically catch up to this ship and get noticed and rescued by the London-based merchant ship called the Indian. On that boat was Owen Chase, Benjamin Lawrence, and Thomas Nickerson. 3 of the original 6 survived. And they were rescued despite not having the strength to climb aboard the ship. Other men had to come down and actually carry them onto the ship. They were in such an extreme state of just, they were so close to death that the captain of the Indian, William Crozier, actually broke down and cried when he saw them. They were extremely pitiful. They were taken on board, given tapioca pudding. It was the perfect food for them to have. It was calorie dense, easy to digest, and high in protein and carbs. They were rescued on the 89th day since they had left the Essex. They had sailed roughly 2,500 miles and actually had sailed with remarkable accuracy. They were right on course with their original plan. Pollard and Ramsdale were the last surviving men in Pollard's boat. They were still floating around. They had run out of food. They had taken to the final extreme measure of breaking open the bones of the shipmates that were in the bottom of their whaleboat and sucking the marrow out in order to survive, which actually provided a good amount of fat, which their bodies so desperately needed. They were so weak they couldn't even lift their hands. They basically were just lying in the bottom of their boat, floating as living skeletons. It was about all that was left of them. February 23, Pollard and Ramsdell were finally rescued by a ship called the Dauphin. I don't know. It's a French name, I think. D-A-U-P-H-I-N. Dauphin. And again, they were so weak that they had to be carried on board and given food that they were able to digest. So there's five survivors at this point. They all made their way to Valparaiso, Chile. And I'm going to skip a little bit ahead. This episode got longer than I expected. Way longer than I expected. So I apologize for that. But they, all five of the men are basically, through a long process, rehabilitated and made their way to Chile. And on March 23, Chase, Lawrence, Nickerson, and Ramsdell got passage home on the whale ship Eagle, which was heading for Nantucket. Pollard was still not healthy enough and did not leave Chile until May. But eventually, they all get back to Nantucket. I think at the latest, Pollard showed up in August, something like that. The three men who stayed on Henderson Island were also rescued. They were rescued by a trading vessel called the Surrey on its way to Australia. They were picked up despite the fact that the Surrey first stopped at the wrong island based on incorrect information from Pollard and Chase, but they were rescued and were able to return home. No one is 100% certain what happened to Hendrick's boat. They were not rescued, and it's not for sure what happened to it. But more than likely is a whaleboat was found on Ducey Island, and it is believed to be the boat of Obed Hendricks. There were four skeletons on the boat. They believe that more than likely it was the skeleton of Isaiah Shepherd, the last crewman to die on Hendrick's boat before they were separated, as well as the three men that were living when they were separated. For, yeah, whatever reason, they floated back towards Henderson and Ducey Island and most likely died in the boat and washed up on shore. But not one survived from Hendrick's boat. Of the original crew of 21, that means 8 men survived. 2 from Pollard's boat, 3 from Chase's boat, and the 3 men that stayed on Henderson Island. Once they got back, just briefly finishing up the careers of the men, George Pollard was given command of a whale ship later on, but in 1823 he was shipwrecked again in a storm, bashed up against a coral reef, and oddly enough, Thomas Nickerson also on that ship. They were quickly rescued, so no ordeal this time. But Pollard's whaling career was over. He was considered a Jonah. It's bad luck. And he became a well-respected and well-liked Nantucket night watchman. Owen Chase became a respected captain and had many years of whaling success. He finally retired in the winter of 1840. In 21 years previous to 1840, he had only spent 5 years at home, and he still managed to get married 4 times. Some of his wives had unfortunately passed away. One of them was divorced due to infidelity, and he had a bunch of kids. So when he was home, he made it worth it. And it was during this time that there was a young man starting his whaling career named Herman Melville, who met Owen Chase's son, who was also a whaleman, on a whaleboat and got the full story of the whale ship Essex, including Owen Chase's written account. And years later, Melville would go on to write the great American classic, Moby Dick, which I actually did not enjoy. But it is considered an American classic novel, and it's based in large part on the Essex disaster and Owen Chase's documented story. Thomas Nickerson and Charles Ramsdale also both returned to whale ships. Ramsdale eventually became a captain. Nickerson tired of it and eventually entered the merchant services as a sailor. Benjamin Lawrence also became a captain, but retired in the early 1840s and bought a small farm on Nantucket. And then less is known about the three men rescued from Henderson Island. Seth Weeks and William Wright worked as crew on the ship that had rescued them, the Surrey, eventually. And at some point, Wright was lost in a hurricane off the West Indies. And then Weeks retired, lived in Cape Cod, and actually was the last surviving member of the Essex. He outlived all the other survivors. And Thomas Chappell, who became extremely religious during his ordeal, returned to London and helped write a religious tract with spiritual lessons from the Essex. And eventually Nickerson wrote in his account that he heard he passed away on the fever-plagued island of Timor. Didn't say when or why he was there, just that he had passed away. So that is briefly the life after their horrific ordeal for the men who survived the Essex. And that is the story of the whale ship Essex. It's a horrific story, and it's hard to believe that it doesn't get more. It's not out there more. I've never heard of it until I kind of stumbled upon this book, and I'll put the citation in the notes for this episode. But it's a fascinating story. I hope that my portrayal in this podcast was fascinating and not just a random bunch of dates and events, but I really enjoyed it despite its horrific nature. It really brings you to perspective when you think things are difficult. You are probably able to go way beyond what you believe is capable, and it's proof with stories like this that the human body and the human mind will always survive as much as possible. And it doesn't matter how. But we're a resilient species. But you remember that. If you're going through a hard time, just remember, it could always be worse before you get better. Anyway, I'm rambling. It's late. This episode went way longer than I intended. I hope you stuck around. I apologize. If you didn't stick around, hopefully you come back next month. I do not know exactly what the next topic will be. There's just too many options to choose from, so check out social media. I will hope to have whatever the next podcast is going to be announced on there soon. But otherwise, check back the first of next month, and you'll be enlightened. But until then, this is Curiosity Chronicles. My name is Brett Bielsma, your host, and I hope that you stay curious.